to the Mary Mac Show, where we will be talking about your feelings, experiences, and pain following the death of a loved one. Today, in part two of my conversation with Chris Didier, we'll talk about Zach's death, who was 17 when he died on December 27, 2020, and how his girlfriend's help, Zach's girlfriend, was instrumental in helping catch the killer of this young man.
When we were piecing this together, and by the way, the big break in our case was his girlfriend.
Really?
Yes, I called her mom or dad that night when we learned. And they had to break the news to their daughter. She's 2 years younger than Zach. She's very young. And the next day she wanted to come go to the house because she just wanted to see for her own eyes. Zach wasn't there. And she stayed in his room for 4.5 hours. Cuddled in his blankets so she could smell him and be near him because she desperately missed him. And as a father, seeing a young 15, almost 16 year old do that, it is just gut wrenching. And no high school kid should have to endure that kind of tragedy, but she didn't know what happened, but she did know his passcode on his phone because they shared the same code. So I checked it, and it opened the phone. The next day, I called the DA's office or law enforcement, and they said, put the phone in airplane mode, turn it off, plug it in, don't touch it. And we're going to have an investigator come out and look at it. And this guy showed up, I think it was the next day. We had family and friends in that house and strangers come to the house to deliver care packages, blankets, food, flowers. So it was kind of a very, busy home. There's a lot of friends and family visiting. And I witnessed this man walk up wearing a Budweiser truck driver shirt and faded jeans and a beard that was out to here and a baseball cap with a big mullet, and did not look like anyone Zach would have known, any of his friends or my family or Laura's family. And his name tag said Hank. And I said, "Can I help you?" And he said, "I'm here to speak to Mr. Didier." And I said, "Well, that's me. What can I do for you, Hank?" And he said, "Oh, shoot. I'm Patrick. And I apologize for my appearance. I'm actually undercover. I just got off a shift. I was told to come out to talk to you about your son's phone. I'm a lead investigator on a task force for our county, a counter-narcotics task force." I said, "Yes, I heard you were coming out." And so it was a bit of an unexpected appearance on his part. And he got into Zach's phone, and it took him maybe 90 seconds before he found the dealer and discovered the dealer had just messaged Zach. So he said, "We have a live bait, live fish, I should say." And they took his phone, and we surrendered it to them. And they did a sting operation, and that's what led eventually to his arrest. There's more to that story, but had we not learned about his passcode from his girlfriend, we would not have, I still think we wouldn't be where we're at now with, holding that person accountable for what they were selling.
Right.
Oh my God. And how is she doing? Do you keep in contact with her?
I have over the years, but not in the last year. And I actually just texted her dad the other day. We're trying to get back together and connect because she had a very challenging senior year in high school. She finished that, last year, and she's doing well. But I'm eager to reconnect. I ran into Zach's friend who was the one who ate or consumed a non-lethal fake pill just about a month ago, and he's doing very well. I keep in touch with Zach's closest friends. He calls them the lads fairly regularly. One of the things that I really have learned, I've learned a lot, and one of the things that I like to describe is what I call a new category of victim because of these losses. Like what happened to Daniel Puerta and Alexander Neville and even Jessica Hilson and Zach and truly countless others. Do you mind if I screen share?
Oh, be my guest.
Okay. Let's see if this works. Okay, do you see a PowerPoint slide?
Yes, the new category of victim.
Okay, so I like to present this at my student assemblies and parent nights when I can. So, as we already know, there is a healthy path. We hear our parents and our teachers and counselors, hey, here's a healthy path to take, right? You need to learn how to eat right, exercise right, and have healthy friend groups. And that's something that's what we're always needing to constantly, make course corrections to stay on a healthy path. And if there's an unhealthy path, that's something we need to try to avoid. And especially when you get into middle school and high school and you start making your own decisions as a young adult, you're going to come across a fork in the road. Like, well, what clothes am I going to wear today? What time do I need to be at school? If I'm driving, what time do I need to leave to go to school? And what path am I going to take to get to school? If you're in a social environment with friends partying, should I have a beer or should I not? And so when it comes to products, you may not realize that the path you're taking is going to be a deadly one or a very dangerous one until you're farther down that path. And typically that path may start out as a first time, like, really, what is this beer like? I will tell you, when I had my first beer, I was underage. I was at a high school party. It was my senior year, and everyone was having something to drink, a hard liquor or beer. And I thought, well, let me try this beer. And it was okay. It wasn't anything that I thought was super awesome. I just held my cup to try to look cool and, get to enjoy my beer. And to some, maybe they like beer or whatever product they're taking, edible or vape or marijuana or whatever, and it becomes a recreational use. Farther down that path, it may become a habit or they become dependent on a product. That slippery slope, that unhealthy path, depending on the product, could be, months or years. And there's always a chance to recover and get back to a healthy path. Because you either grow up and you age out of it, and you realize, hey, I need to get my grades better. I need to stop this habit, or maybe the intervention from family and friends. However, now that there's illicit fentanyl in the world and being marketed and peddled, it's a very different landscape. This landscape that I'm showing you now is what I call the old landscape. When I go to high school assemblies, I tell these kids, this is what your parents had when they were your age, but
That's right.
this isn't what you get now. Now it's one time and it's out. One pill, one line, one bump, one time, and it's over. And the fastest growing victim group are those who are naive, who are inexperienced. And many of our teens are getting advice from parents, well, hey, if you try a joint, if you try alcohol, if you try this or try that, there's always a chance to recover to that healthy path, but we can't live with that mindset anymore. And I try really hard to tell these students in middle school and high school, like, guys, this is the new landscape. It's more like a minefield now. It's not a slippery slope. And it's so unfair. Your generation has to have this because your parents didn't have that when they were your age. They didn't have that to worry about. Like, if I tried just even half of this product, I could be dead in, less than 10 minutes. They didn't have that danger. And when we were growing up in middle or high school, tried something, the worry was, getting nauseous, getting a hangover, getting embarrassed. Today, it's your lights out. And if unless someone happens to be right next to you and can give you immediate care, like naloxone, you're not going to survive. And that's so unfair to our younger generation. That's part of the education that they have to try to take with them, and that we can't just experiment and, hey, let's check this now. This isn't the world we live in.
I totally agree with you. And I've been saying that the days of experimental drug use is over. It's completely over. I mean, just like you said, when we were growing up, it was like, oh, I want to try this, let's try a little of that. And you could trust what somebody was giving you because they were using it themselves and they were perfectly fine. But
Yeah.
nowadays, our most trusted friends can give us something and we have no idea where they got it, what's in it, who was handling it before it came to us.
Right.
And I
Absolutely.
agree. I feel badly for these young people. And it's not even young people. I mean, you've got people who are accustomed to doing coke, who are business executives. Right. And they get a bad batch or from the wrong person and they're dead. I've read and seen, many 30-year-olds up in Connecticut and Manhattan, and they're just dropping
Yeah.
because they have no idea that the coke was laced with fentanyl. And they're shocked. And all their, colleagues, they're shocked. I mean, how did this happen? It was no reason for it.
I think those cases are equally tragic. Someone thinks they're taking a safe amount of some kind of product, whether it's legal or illegal, and if they don't realize fentanyl has been added to it, or it's fake, made only of fentanyl, and they don't know that, that's a new category of victim. And it's absolutely a horrific reality of what we live in. And as Steve Filson likes to look at it, but for fentanyl, if fentanyl was not at all involved, whether it was just a beer or a pill or cocaine or whatever product, a vape, of edible, then that person would have had the old, the old landscape model. At least they get a chance to learn life's lessons. Now, none of us condone anyone wanting to self-medicate or experiment with a, controlled substance or underage drinking or underage consuming or any of that. But no one should lose their life for that, especially if they're deceived.
Completely agree with you. It's
Now, I wanted to add.
the irony too is that there's the controlled substance fentanyl that is used for, in a patch form to help you can, and then there's the illicit, illegal kind that just kills.
Well, that's actually a great segue to what I call terminology. And it's important to talk about it. As anyone can understand, when there's a new crisis in our country, it can be, there's a limited knowledge or very limited understanding, of what's really happening here. And usually, new terminology to better describe what's going on, to better describe the danger, can help better describe a solution. And I think there's many terms that are potentially confusing or misleading. The three main ones, I have found there are three main ones that I really think are good to talk about. And you just hit the first one. Legitimate versus illicit. As you know, because of your personal experience after having a bad accident, legitimate fentanyl actually has helped millions of people.
Yes.
Legitimate fentanyl that was produced in a certified lab that's used for very specific purposes under very close observation, whether it's heavy surgery or recovery from surgery, dispensed in a duodecic patch for a very specific thing. And a lot of people benefit from that. And I think that's a great drug. But what we're talking about is illicit, illicit defined as a product made unlawfully, without regulation, or without authority, and without control. And I think that's an important distinction to make, because if we demonize just fentanyl, possible we're going to close the ears and minds of a listener who they themselves or family they care about have significantly benefited from legitimate fentanyl.
Yes.
So I'm pro legitimate fentanyl, especially if it's really helpful to people. What we really want to focus is on illicit fentanyl. And I try my best, I don't always do it, to say illicit in front of the word fentanyl. The
Right.
second one is laced versus fake. And I see this a lot.
Okay.
Laced is, by definition, in my mind, is to adulterate or contaminate with a substance into a known product or known substance. So the term cocaine laced with fentanyl, I think, is accurate by definition. But when I see reporters or on the news, pills laced with fentanyl or fentanyl laced pills, I think can be misleading, because it can conjure, by definition of what laced is, it can conjure the notion of, oh, these are real pills that somehow had fentanyl put in it, just like cocaine had fentanyl put in it. That's
Oh, I
not
see.
what's
That's
happening.
no.
It could conjure the mind that, well, maybe some dealer broke into mom and dad's medicine cabinet and took legitimate oxycodone or Xanax or Percocet or Adderall, and they somehow sprinkled fentanyl in it. But that, again, is not what's happening. I've worked with multiple crime labs throughout the US, most of which are DEA, and I've asked them, have you ever come across a legitimate pharmaceutical grade pill that somehow had been altered and adulterated with fentanyl? And they said, no. We either see the real thing or fake. And 99% of what we come across are fake. And there's no legitimate anything in it. It's just counterfeit, like, counterfeit money.
Yes.
This $100 bill isn't partly real and partly counterfeit. It's all fake or all real. So I like to use the term a fake pill made of fentanyl instead of laced with fentanyl, because I think that more accurately describes it. And then the third
That's a very good
one,
point. No, that's a very good point.
and
Very
the
good
third
point.
one is, I'm sure you've heard, is the difference between an overdose and
Oh
poisoning.
yes. Oh yes.
Yeah, and I
Just,
think we
and how I discuss that, if you don't mind me jumping in a minute,
yeah, go
is
for it.
that you don't have a 3-year-old dying of fentanyl because his parents were irresponsible in their house and they were all doing drugs with their friends and the little one's killed. That is not an overdose. There is no such thing as a 3-year-old doing drugs and overdosing. So why would you say that a 17-year-old or a 20 or 25-year-old who is not involved in any of that would be overdosing? No, it was a one-shot deal that killed them.
Right.
That's how I feel.
I can't agree with you anymore. And I like to use the 1982 tragedy of the extra strength Tylenol bottles that were tampered
Yes.
with. The first,
Remember it.
yeah, there were seven people who died. the government came in and they cleaned out all the shelves of Tylenol, and that's where they invented the tamper-proof seal because people thought they were taking extra-strength Tylenol to manage cramps or headaches when they consumed a potassium cyanide tablet that looked and mimicked like a Tylenol pill. That is not, can't say they overdosed on Tylenol because there was no Tylenol. And why would you say you overdosed on potassium cyanide? They didn't know they were taking that. When you look at the manner of a person's death, not just the mechanism, but the manner, I think a poisoning more accurately describes what is going on here. And that's a common problem because in all of our advocacy work, I think the biggest struggle that we have, and all the nonprofits that are out there, and I know families from almost all of them, I've seen our biggest struggle is one thing, and that is stigma. Stigma of those who have no direct experience or understanding of what's happening, and they think of what they do know, and that is, oh, the war on drugs, the person who's unhoused in an alley with a needle in their arm, and you know, those, that's a tragic situation there, but that's not on them, because then the addiction gets connected, and if addiction is attached to our story, like Zach's or Daniel's or Alexander's or Jessica's, then our message is lost. Like, hey, this is not what you think. This is something very, very different, and we really need to educate ourselves.
I completely agree, and it's horrible that that stigma is there. You know, I mean, in the past, there are people who were having it, you know, a very difficult time with whatever substance they were using, and they may have recovered and then gone to rehab and, you know, and developed a productive life that didn't have anything in their system, and they built a whole different life. But nowadays, we don't have that option anymore. Most people who are taking all these different kind of drugs, they have no idea when some fentanyl is going to appear.
You know, if you were to go to a bar and watch a World Series with your friends, and you just turned 21, right? And it's your favorite team, and you bought beer at the bar, and and you see what looks like a home run, and everyone's glued to the screen, and you're yelling and all that. And while that was happening, someone adulterated your beer with potassium cyanide. And you drink that beer. Is it your fault that you were in a bar drinking beer? Well, you're kind of culpable. You shouldn't have been dealing with your addiction of drinking beer. Or is it the person's the person who puts that beer in, or that cyanide in your beer, that's the person that should be responsible? Who's at fault here? Obviously, it's the person who puts the cyanide in the beer, right?
Absolutely.
What do you
Or
think?
the gentlemen, well, they're not gentlemen, the rapists who put roofies in a girl's drink at the bar and they don't know and they collapse. And the next thing you know, this poor girl is raped.
Right.
And, you know,
Yeah,
they're
absolutely.
the culprit. It has nothing to do with what she was drinking,
Or
has
what she's
nothing to do
wearing
where
or
she
something.
was, what she was wearing. Exactly. When we were trying to change laws with homicide, one of the big sticklers and the stigmas, like we talk about, was what exactly was she wearing? And if she was wearing something provocative, then it served her right. She should have been killed. She should have been raped. And we would go through this in court. It was ridiculous. The defense attorney would say all these things. And it's not exactly the same, but it's on that level. You know, let's blame the person who was hurt, you know, the victim or the person who was killed. Let's blame them. And
You know what? That's such a really good point. And going back to the example of a person at a bar at a World Series game and on their 21st birthday. Well, what if they were, this game was the day before they were turning 21, and there were only hours of being legally allowed to drink? Does it make a difference then? Well, you were not technically legal because your birthday was at midnight and it's 6 at night. So you were 6 hours. So now it's your fault because you were as a minor drinking.
Right.
Clearly, it should make no difference. Well, what if they're 1 year from turning 21 or 5 years from turning 21? The focus isn't that, well, they were underage drinking. It doesn't matter. The crime was putting something in a drink in this example. And sadly, one of the very first public safety committee hearings about trying to promote a new law or bill, I should say, introducing a bill that brings accountability to those who are dealing. One of the, in fact, I think he at the time was the chair saying, hey, the person consuming, they need to share the culpability of what happened on their actions. And that was a very offensive line that they said, because it's like, if the person's legally allowed to be in a bar to drink, then it's clearly on the person who put something in that drink. But if they're 1 day younger, then that's not just only their fault. I'm sorry, but I don't agree with that. That's
Yep.
like driving your teenager driving on the freeway at night for the first time with their new license, going 10 miles over the speed limit, and a drunk driver going the wrong way 120 miles an hour and causes massive devastation. And if it's shown, well, your teenager was driving 10 miles over the speed limit with the flow of traffic, since they were technically breaking the law, they need to also be partially at fault for this accident and the fact they died. It is everything to do with the drunk driver going the wrong way. I agree.
Absolutely. No, I totally agree with you. And then you had the unscrupulous, defense attorneys who will just,
I know they're kind
they
of.
have no sense of right and wrong. They just
Can I
want to
share one other important aspect
win. Absolutely.
this? Why? So, as you mentioned, I'm a member of Victims of Illicit Drugs, VOID. And there were many other quality nonprofits out there, I think, that have worked alongside with like several. So many of grieving families who are all in the same mindset. We need to educate. One of the more important parts is to why we have to educate, especially to our youth. So, I'm going to try something here. So I had made this. I don't know if you could see
Yep,
it. Okay.
I can see the grid, the
Okay.
graph.
So this is I call this fentanyl increase in fentanyl deaths or a percentage of growth. And as you can see over here is a percentage of growth, and on the bottom are the age demographics. And if you look at this 19 to about 69, this is information that came down from CDC, and here's their website. So I put it in this chart. And I downloaded fentanyl deaths in 2015 and compared it to 2022. And as you can see in those age demographics, the average growth is eightfold, an eightfold increase in fentanyl deaths in 2022, eightfold increase in 2022 for those ages. Another way of saying it is, 8 times more people died in 2022 than in 2015. But why we need to get into schools, down here, is because look what the difference is. 17-fold increase of deaths in 2022 for those ages.
Oh my
High
goodness.
school kids. That's a 1,000, what's that, 600% increase in fentanyl deaths in 2022 than in 2015. And looks like 2023 is even worse because there is a marked sharp rise of teen deaths. because 2023 numbers are not finalized past August right now, probably in about 3 months, I'm going to come up with a new version of this. It's probably going to be just as bad, if not worse. But what I wanted to point out here is, as it's shown in yellow, this age group towers over all the other age demographics of the fastest growing victim group, and why it's so important to get in front of students in schools and campuses, particularly middle, high school and college age demographics, and just say, hey guys, there's a new category of victim. Here's the danger. Here's how lethal. Here's how pervasive it is. Here's the trickery that's going on social media. Here's how social media apps are being exploited. And you just need to be aware of like how this is happening. It's absolutely paramount we get this to the generation that's connected.
Totally agree. And it's hard for these kids to really grasp what's going on unless they've known someone who was killed by it. I don't think it really connects with them, you know? And that's what's so sad. I'm glad to do these interviews, these conversations, because these young people need to know more about it. They need to hear from parents who have gone through this, you know? And maybe that will jar them. Maybe that will help them understand how lethal, you know, how devastating, how it changes the whole dynamic of a family when a young person is killed in this way, in any way, but especially this way, because you think it can be prevented, but not always. You know, they're
Right.
thinking they're getting one drug or one something, and they get something completely different. And it's like you said, it's completely counterfeit. It has nothing to do with the real drug.
I think that one of the biggest probably mindset that we need to challenge is the idea that, well, that the chances of this happening are not going to happen to me.
Right.
A great example are four cases that happened the summer of 2021 in our area, in like probably I want to say a 15 square mile area.
Okay.
And that is so Laura and I were interviewed by our local media, and then there was a national interview with Kate Snow on Dateline and or Nightly News, sorry. And we started working with Sacramento County and the county I live in, Placer County, creating a One Pill Can Kill campaign. And there were multiple news stories going on. And then, of course, we go to the Capitol trying to promote and support laws to help bring accountability here. Well, there was a, like I said, there were four stories. I'll give you an example of one where a mother explained to their son, have you heard of this thing called a fake pill? Do you know about fentanyl? And they were like, wow, I didn't know, I didn't understand. Mom, don't worry, blah, blah, blah. Well, as you can understand, I'm sure can guess, they came across a pain pill they thought was legit, and it was fentanyl. And by the act of God, Grandpa happened to walk by his bedroom, probably going to the bathroom, I think, and heard really unusual, loud, gurgling sound, snoring sound, and thought that was very unusual. And went to check on him and realized something's not right. He called 911. They Narcanned him. Went to the hospital, and he survived. He was enormously lucky he survived. And
Yes,
of
for
course,
sure.
mom, what's that?
For sure. I mean,
Right.
his grandfather saved his life.
Just because he happened to walk by and see that something doesn't seem right here. This is unusual. Well, when he, was about to get discharged from the hospital, and then mom, dad, family were there, and he told mom, because she was crying, she said, "I can't believe you took a pill. What the hell? We talked about this. Do you remember Zach's story?" And he said, "Yeah, I'm so sorry, Mom. I never ever want you to go through that pain that Laura Didier did, Zach's mom did. Because, his mom said, I don't want to go through what Zach's mom went through. As a mom, I cannot imagine. I don't ever want to come there." And he was very emotional and said, "I'm so sorry. I will never, never do that." Guess what?
Oh, don't
Four
tell
months
me.
later.
He did, and he died.
Correct. And that's one of four young people in our area throughout the summer of 2021. And it made me think, why, even knowing Zach's story and having had a personal close call experience they themselves had, and still they came across a fake pill. Now, in his example, he went back, he fully recovered and was dealing with anxiety. I think he had a I don't know if I'm remembering it correctly, if he was diagnosed with ADHD or had some struggles with depression. There was something that he had been, working on that lots of people are well within his abilities to manage it. But he decided to go back to his dealer for convenience and say, "Hey, I want an Adderall pill to focus. And I don't want a fake one, not like what you sold me last time, because that was a fake pill." And his friend said, "Yeah, I didn't realize that. I thought all my stuff's legit, but I've cleaned my act, and I get all my supplies from a reputable provider."
Sure, you do.
And he said, "Well, I need an Adderall to focus." And I forgot what he was doing in his life. And the dealer says, "I got you. I've tested it. It's totally legit." And he said, "Okay, as long as it's not fake, we're good to go." But it was fake, and it had fentanyl, and it killed him.
They
So
catch that guy and put him in jail?
I don't know. I don't know. But what
And
really,
these other three, did they die also?
very similar stories. They knew about fake pill. They had a personal experience, and all four of them, to some degree, thought, "Well, I really don't. I think the chances are really small. And yeah, there's a danger out there, but the likelihood of it coming across my path is very insignificant." So when I do these assemblies, and I know these numbers, the DEA estimates over 99% of what's sold on social media or on the streets, basically not from a pharmacy. I should add, not from a US pharmacy. If it's on the street or social media, it's fake. It's 99% are fake. And now 7 out of 10 have the potential to be lethal. So if you're getting a pill that's not from your pharmacist, it's a 70% chance it's going to kill you. And Western DEA labs, last year, they analyzed 3 million tablets. I know, because I did a presentation for them and got a tour of their lab. And they test around 85% of what's seized or have the potential to be lethal. That 7 out of 10 is an average throughout the US. On the West Coast, it's worse. So if we're living on the West Coast, it's much more risky than maybe rural places. I'm not sure where the average goes down, but it's really dangerous here on the West Coast.
So please, before we conclude, I really want to hear what happened to the dealer that gave Zach that pill.
Well, they performed a sting operation. Of course, while they're investigating, they interviewed Zach's friend, who's 1 year younger, and they found surveillance video at our mall. Fortunately, he was not wearing a mask, because again, we're still at the tail end of COVID. And they were able to kind of positively or come up with a visual idea of his face.
Wow, that was really Wow, chances of that are slim, right?
Back then, yeah. But they got a very good description from the surviving friend. They set up another meeting, but canceled it right at the very last second. But what they really were doing is to see him, confirm that is him, cancel the meeting, and he walks away. So they followed him. So then they got to see his car. And his license, they followed where he went. Now they knew where he lived. So they're now surveilling him for a few weeks, and where he's going and his whatnot. Eventually they arrested him, I think about a month after Zach died, which was enormously quick. And
Yes.
they levied charges, and he posted bail that night. His first call was to his family, and he said, "I need to get, I'm in jail in Placer County." He lives in our neighboring county, Sacramento County. And he told his mom and dad, "I need you to help me get out of post bail. Here's where I'm at. But before you do that, I need you to go to these websites and cancel these accounts right now." And they did, and they posted bail, and he didn't stay that night. When they booked him, they realized he was about 3 months into his 5-year probation in Sacramento County for weapons and drug-related crimes.
Wow.
So he had a history. He had other arrest history, but the big one was the Sacramento County 5-year probation. Which triggered an arrest warrant for violating his probation in Sacramento County. So Placer County couldn't detain him because he posted bail, but they, of course, alerted Sacramento County, "Hey, we just arrested this guy and discovered that he's on probation. We wanted to let you know we're arresting him. We had arrested him for being alleged as a drug provider, a drug dealer." Which resulted in a fatality, and we're prosecuting. And so Sacramento County arrest him for violating their probation, 5-year probation for weapons and drug related crimes. It took them a month to find him and arrest him. He resisted arrest. They had to detain him. In his possession were two firearms. One of them had been filed off the serial number, which is a federal crime. A slew of various controlled products and illegal or illicit drugs and 40 Xanax bars.
Wow.
This man's journey with drugs and weapons go about 8 months earlier when he was caught in Sacramento County, convicted and sentenced to 5 years probation, no jail time. 2 months later, he meets Zach. A month later, he gets arrested in our county. A month later, he's rearrested in Sacramento County. He's now serving a 17-year sentence for what happened to Zach. The initial charges were various narcotic possession and furnishing or selling to a minor and whatnot. The heaviest charge was involuntary manslaughter, but our county's second drug-related homicide was a little more of a public case because it involved a pitcher for the same San Francisco Giants, Logan Webb, his cousin, Cade Webb. And when they were investigating that case, they took a lot of the lessons from Zach's case and were able to determine they have a strong enough case to file murder. So when they decided to do that, the DA's office called Laura and I, Zach's mom, and I back to the office and said, "We have a new case. We're filing murder for that. And we reevaluated Zach's case, and we're going to add a murder charge to Zach's dealer."
Very good. Very
And
good.
when they did that, the Zach's dealer's defense attorney brokered a deal to basically plea bargain with the DA to accept all of the charges at the maximum sentencing, since there were multiple charges that at the time did not include murder. They said, "Well, if we'll plead guilty to all these initial charges as long as you don't add murder." All those charges added up to 17 years,
Wow.
which to me was a sign because that's how old Zach is. And we accepted, or the DAs accepted that, and that was kind of how it resulted in that gentleman's sentencing.
Well, I'm glad to know that he was caught and convicted and he's behind bars, and at least this one can't do any more damage to other people.
I've learned a lot in my advocacy efforts. I learned a lot from other parents. I gain a lot of strength. So this is a club none of us want to be in, as you know.
Yes.
But I've learned a lot, and I've gained a lot of strength from so many parents. The first family to really help me and Laura was the Ternans, Ed and Mary Ternan, who run a nonprofit called Song for Charlie. I quickly met Matt Capilouto, who's the president of Drug Induced Homicide. And then I met, of course, Jaime and Amy and Steve. And there's the list is long. And I think what helps me compartmentalize things to help fight this crisis is to break it down into three spaces. Or lanes, I guess. The first one is awareness and education, which we talk a lot about. We shared some specifics and some of the evidence or science and the statistics that I think is so important for our youth to and parents to learn about the changing landscape and the danger and the deception. Another space is I like to call the prevention and treatment. And I group those together because I think they go hand in hand. So those who struggle with a drug addiction, and now there are many who struggle with fentanyl addiction because they came across fentanyl, survived that encounter, and now they're addicted to it. And now they're struggling with the shackles of addiction. And to help them with not just immediate treatment, but effective treatment. It includes a lot of conversations about prevention and how to prevent them from going back to taking that drug. I think that space, I'm still learning a lot. It's probably the biggest space, and there's so much to talk about and so many variances there. And I'm learning. And then the third space is the accountability space. And of those three spaces, I think that one is the one we are woefully, woefully behind in. I've done a lot of work, or trying to do a lot of work with legislation to amp that up. And as far as the accountability space, there's two lanes. One is holding people accountable for peddling poison for profit, those who are willingly and intentionally selling something. Knowing that, hey, there's a chance this could actually be lethal, but hopefully not, and I can get them to come back. Those people need to be held accountable. And the other lane of that is social media. I'm a strong believer that social media is still a wild west right now, and that there are needed safeguards and appropriate, like measures that need to take place to make it safer for their consumers, so that people cannot just openly advertise and conduct nefarious or illegal business on these platforms. And part of a solution is to change our laws and say, look, if you're going to do business in our country that connects millions of people, you're going to need a license. And to have a license, you need to demonstrate you can police your site by allowing, and you need to allow us to come and inspect your site. If you're going to run a restaurant, you are subject to having random and no notice health inspectors check to see how you process your food, how you store and label food. If you run a dry cleaner or a coffee shop, you need a license to do that, and anyone can sue you if you have an unsafe environment and someone gets hurt. But right now, laws protect social media companies from being legally liable for that. When we need to hold them responsible to police their sites and prevent people from doing illegal activities. So I think that space of holding dealers accountable and bringing social media responsible, holding them responsible for making it safer, is there's a lot of work that needs to be done there. And I'm trying to put a lot of energy into that space.
And may I add one other segment of that space?
Yes.
Judges need to be held accountable for what they don't do when someone is murdered because of drugs. So, in other words, there was a magistrate, I think is the title he has, in Pittsburgh area, Allegheny County. And there were three dealers who had hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of illicit opioids. Okay. He let them all out on bail. See, that angers me more because these judges will not be accountable in their own right for protecting the people in their communities. All they needed to do was put these guys behind bars for. I mean, first of all, no bail, okay, no bail before the trial. And they claimed that there was enough fentanyl between them, it could have killed everyone in Pennsylvania. That's crazy. And those people come before a judge, and a judge doesn't think that that's a valid reason for keeping these guys behind bars before their trial. See, that makes me very angry. Because I've seen so many judges who have not done the right thing with murderers. And these people in my mind are murderers.
I agree. I think the judges there was a similar case in California, and the judges are like, "Hey, I'm just following the laws. You need to talk to the lawmakers." Okay, we'll go to the lawmakers too. But there is some discretion. If you feel as a judge there's danger to public safety,
Yes.
then you need to be the one that says, "Well, I'm posting a bail here," that or requiring a bail to be posted so that it is commensurate to the potential danger to society.
See, but from my perspective, someone who is caught with that much that would kill that many people, there should be no bail whatsoever, and it should be a given.
With what's in the news recently, and this is just not much different than last year, how many million lethal doses were seized just by DEA alone is more than enough to kill every man, woman, and child in our country.
That's right.
Do you know how
So when
much?
the DEA comes across those people, what are they doing to keep them behind bars?
That's a good question.
I
Do you
mean,
know
you
how much?
shouldn't have them out on the street. You should have them behind bars waiting for whatever trial is, whatever hearing is coming up.
You know what percentage is estimated to be seized?
Say that again. What percentage?
What is the estimate on how much is being seized as a percentage? So
I don't know.
whatever's coming into the country, we're seizing, like DEA seized a record 386 million deadly lethal doses of fentanyl in 2023, and they broke it down into 12,000 pounds of fentanyl powder and more than 77 million lethal pills. It was a 119% increase in the number of pills that were seized compared to the year before. So, what percentage is that of all of the stuff trying that's coming into our country? How much are they seizing? What do you think?
I think if it's 15 to 20%, it's a lot.
I was hoping for at least 25 to 30, but I was I've heard multiple times. The first one was when I was a participant in a severe SEFTARS roundtable, Safer Pharmaceuticals or Safer Pharmacies roundtable in September of 2021. I specifically asked that question, and the senior operations manager named Mac or Steve Mac McConaughey said, "Chris, honestly, I think at best we're seizing 5%. I've heard others say around 10% as of 2022, a year later, and now I'm hearing it's probably no more than 10, probably 5. So if 380, what was it, 386 million lethal doses were seized in 2023, well, if that's no more than 10%, where's the other 90%? That's over 3 billion lethal doses in just 1 year. And it was the same the year before and the same be so there's multiple billion lethal doses. And it's like, okay, wait a second. When we have people with this much, like you were describing, being arrested and caught with these products, they're going to be able to get a bunch more the very that night they're back on the street. It's readily available. So it's absolutely important to keep them detained as long as possible, just until the investigation can reveal really what's going on and if these people deserve to be arrested for a long term. It's sad. And I also looked up vital statistics just before we started. I don't know if you've ever been on their
Oh,
CDC vital.
yes, many times because every year I would go on to find out how many murders there were in the country, where they were, what ages they were, you know, yes.
Well, as of this morning when we logged in, it was as of August of 2023, it reported 106,363 people died from all types of drugs. When you look at fentanyl, it's 73,845. They had predicted 78, or they predict it's actually 78,000 because of incomplete data. Jaime Parts's son's story is a great example. He's not registered as a death from fentanyl because of it was early in this stage. I think Alexandra Capaluto's was the same. So when you take 78,000 and divide that by 365, just fentanyl, you're over 200 people every day. If you include all types of drugs, 112,000, that's like 300 people every day. So when just looking only at one drug, just fentanyl, that's a pretty sizable airplane crash every day. And that's been like 2.5 years. It's the highest average fatality rate than anything our country's ever experienced, with one exception, and that was COVID, the 2 years we were suffering from COVID. It exceeds every war our country's ever been in. The most deadly
Oh,
war
yeah.
our country's been in is on soil, in U.S. soil, was what was it, the
Civil
Civil
War, right?
War.
Civil War.
Where actually I have that right here. From 1861 to 1865, 214,938 losses. The average is 118 day casualty losses. World War II was the worst average daily fatality rate of 178 every day. World War II. But we've been losing more than that at 200 just from fentanyl. And much of that, sadly, is in the privacy of our children's homes, apartments, dorms, in their privacy of their bedroom. And we have to make this our country's number one priority, or top 1%, to figure how do we stop these deaths. Holding dealers, judges, social media accountable, and responsible to do something about it, I think is an essential first or important step. Education awareness is probably the biggest tool in our tool bag because it's immediate. And when a kid learns and realizes, oh my gosh, that's a horrible odds. That's like playing Russian roulette. But I think Amy Neville called it Russian pillet because Russian roulette is one bullet. When you're dealing with fake pills, you got a bullet every other chamber, or if not more. It's 7 out of 10. So, you really need to understand this is enormously risky.
I want to just thank you for all this education, for sharing everything about your journey.
Thank you, Mary.
I can't even imagine, especially that Zach was such an accomplished child, and for something like this to happen, people just don't understand. And sometimes there is no explanation, but it still happens.
I think that when you really think about it, all of our endings may be as indelible as those we've loved and lost. But I really like to believe that life is more than that, and it's what we make of it. And what I've learned from Zach and so many other stories of other young children who were deceived to death, they learn to live life to its fullest, to wear life gloriously, and to figure a way to make it better, to make the light all the brighter despite, your darkest days. And maybe, that's why we're all here. People like you and people that work with other, nonprofits like we were talking about with Void. To show each other and to show the world that life has purpose and meaning, and that we need to do something about it.
Yes.
Tragedy strikes everybody. I learned this, and it's usually unpredicted, and oftentimes evenly. But so there's inconsistency there. But one thing that is consistent is that when tragedy strikes, we all have a choice. We can
Absolutely.
choose to do something or not do something.
Yes.
Lisa Nichols describes this well, who's a life coach.
Yes, I know her.
Great lady. And she said, we can choose to use our pain to build a fortress, to hide from the world, or a fuel to change it. And like you and so many others on that you've interviewed, we are choosing to make a difference. And it's a beautiful thing in the way when you look at it, like Zach is helping people. That's what he wanted to do. So are so many other young kids
Yes.
who died this way. Their story is making a difference. And if it's another kid that sees their story and realize, gosh, that's such a relatable kid. That looks like me or my brother or my buddy or my boyfriend or girlfriend. They really listen, and so it's so important to talk about this and get this out.
Completely agree. And as you said, like education is really the staple, is to help these young people realize that this could happen in their life. They could be offered something, and how important it is to, unfortunately, the trust factor is everything. Who do you trust? Do you trust the dealer on Snapchat? Do you trust the friend of theirs who tells them, oh, it's fine. We took this last week. It's just fine. We can't trust the way we did when we were younger. We don't have the same world we did when we were kids and we'd go out with our bikes and be gone for all day and come home. And, when the lights went, when the lights came on the street lights and lamps and
Right. Yeah.
that's
Come
how
home
we lived
early.
our life. Yeah, come home when the lights go on. And We had our relatives and our neighbors always looking out for us. We don't have that anymore. We live in a completely different world, and I don't think these kids, I mean, we have that experience because of the age we're at, but the youngest of our in our families, they don't have that. And it really does take quite a bit of education and love, to learn that. I had a wonderful woman who wrote a, I can't remember her name right now, but she w wrote a review on the podcast site. And she said, "Thank you so much for making this available for me because my son and I, we both listen to your podcast, and he has learned so much about this from you." And that made me feel because he knows, and hopefully he'll tell other people his age. And obviously, God willing, that mother would never bury that son. Thank you again. I'm so glad to know you, Chris. I'm sorry it was under these circumstances. We honor Zach's memory. We honor all that your other children and Zach's mother have gone through. But mostly, what you're doing for other people is going to make such a difference, and I'm sure it has. And as I always say, we may never know what our words did for others, but that's okay. When we get to heaven, we'll figure it out.
Yeah, exactly. There was a let me see, you reminded me of something I'd learned. It was at the DEA summit. Your worst day may be someone else's best day. Your light may be the only light someone else sees. Tragedy does not build character, it reveals character. And adversity is a horrible thing to waste.
That's very nice, very profound, very profound. Well, I think the two of us are made from the cloth of that we wanted to do something that would make a difference from all the tragedy we endured. And
True.
that's what I'm grateful I get to do that because I know a lot of people who, they stayed stuck in their sorrow, and I will remember not to stay stuck in your sorrow. Do something for somebody else, be grateful for what we do have every day because we are living examples that we don't know when tragedy will strike us again, and so I'd like to think that being grateful for what we do have now. I always tell my folks, write five things in your journal every night that you're grateful for. It could be the smallest thing, it could be the candle that we bought, it could be anything, but we're focusing on the good instead of the sorrow. And so that I think that's important. Thank you, Chris.
Well, thank you, Mary Mac. I'm really honored to have a chance to share our stories and to help bring awareness and education. It's really needed. So thank you again for all the work you've done and what you continue to do. So.
Thank you so much, Chris. Pleasure to know you. And
Likewise.
please, excuse me.
Likewise.
Thank you. Thank you. So, to my audience, please share this interview, share these words of wisdom that Chris has given you. And whether you subscribe, share, like, comment, review, we need all of it because it's important that we get this out into the algorithms to do more and spread the word longer, farther, and to people who really do need it. So thank you. Have a great night.
Thank you. Stay safe.
I know, too.